on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with 76-year-old Lonis Wigger, two-time Olympic gold medalist marksman and the only shooting sports competitor to be inducted to the U.S. Olympic Hall of Fame. Originally from Carter, Montana, he lives in Colorado Springs, Colorado now. That, of course, is home to the U.S. Olympic Training Center, where he volunteers his time to help the shooters of today and tomorrow. Olympic athletes now can devote nearly every waking hour of every day to what becomes a real consuming pursuit. And Lonis Wigger is as determined and disciplined as anyone. But let's put it in perspective. Early 1967, Lonis Wigger is 29 years old. He has a wife, three young children. He already has an Olympic gold medal in three-position small-bore rifle, a silver in the prone event when you lay down flat on your stomach and fire bullseyes. Both of those medals earned in the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. But now he receives orders to go to Vietnam. Hard to imagine one of our Olympic heroes today heading over to Iraq or Afghanistan, isn't it? What was it like for you heading to Southeast Asia, not knowing whether you'd ever see your wife and kids again?
Well, it was tough. Actually, it was probably a lot tougher on her than it was me for that year, because she was responsible for taking care of three young kids and maintaining the household and the whole thing while I was gone for that year. I actually was assigned to MACV, which is Military Assistance Command, and I was sent to the Delta to a small outpost. I think we had about 50 people in our compound. Started out, I worked with the ag people, advising with them, and we had very few roads in the Delta where I wasn't. Drunk in. And if you traveled, you usually went by sampan. So I'd go out, and today we'd go out with an ag advisor, and we'd cut down the canals in the sampan and get way in the hell out there somewhere and have lunch with the locals. And I was probably too dumb to realize I shouldn't have been out there. And I didn't even have a radio with me or anything. All I had was a little M2 carbine, which is, if you shot somebody with it, all it would do was probably tick them off. It wouldn't hurt them any. But I remember one time having lunch with the village chief and seven or eight others, and I had a little interpreter with me, a young kid, about 16, and we were sitting around this big table, and they had a big pot in the center, and they dipped out some food on our plates, and I didn't know what it was. It was meat, but I didn't know what it was. So I picked it up and ate it around the bone and so on, and there were these little plastic beads that I found. I don't know what they were. I just laid them on my plate, and so I wasn't in the conversation because I didn't speak Vietnamese, but well, I went bad, I'll get me another piece. So I dipped in the big bowl and come down and brought up. It was a chicken head. And then I saw what the little V's were, their beaks. So I looked around, nobody saw me. I put it back in and pushed it down and looked around, got something else and brought it out and ate it. But it was a pretty good experience. And I really enjoyed that tour. It was a lot of fun working with the Vietnamese. And later on, I was the advisor to the RFPF Training Center, which was there. That's with the lower level Vietnamese troops, and I went out and operated with them some too. It was a pretty good tour. I was glad it was over with, though.
Your story is really unique. So I don't know how many people can claim to have won an Olympic gold medal, gone over to Vietnam, come back, gone to another Olympics, and then gone back to Vietnam again, and then another Olympics and another Olympics. So was it different for you going to Mexico City now that you have been to Vietnam and back, experienced some of that, and everything you'd been through at that point? Was it different than that eye-opening experience you had in Tokyo?
No, not really. I mean, it was your goal always to make the Olympic team. And, of course, at that point, it's not only the goal to make the team, it's the goal to win. I got back in February of 68. In fact, I came right out right in the middle of the Tet invasion, if you remember hearing anything about that. I was able to get to Saigon. And I was at this little hotel we were going to leave the next day. And I saw them putting airstrikes in at the racetrack, which is like 2 miles away. You could see all that. We were up on the top floor watching it. And I went out the next day, and the airplane was only half full because people that were supposed to zero us on that date couldn't get there. So I was fortunate I got to get out about 3 days early. I got back in February, and then we had our trials in the spring for the 68 Olympic Games. And we had the trials in Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio. I was leading going into the third day. Different squatting on the third day. They squatted us in order where we placed. So I was squatted on point one, and Tommy Poole, who had been my teammate in Tokyo, was squatted on point two. You're shooting out of this small building. Just inside of the building was point one, so the building ended right there. Well, the wind was coming from behind, and it was whipping around the building and down the firing line, and the people on the end didn't work very well. The wind ate us up. The people that made the team actually were like fifth and sixth in line that day. So, yeah, I felt like I should have been there, and I should have been on top of my game. As it ended up, I got to go and shoot the prone, the 60-shot prone match. And I shot all right, but I didn't shoot very well, so I didn't win anything the next day. I was pretty disappointed, though. I didn't get to shoot the big match that I wanted to shoot in.
I know we're going to get to 72 and what happened there and your unique perspective on all of it, but before that, you had to go back to Vietnam. Was that tough to swallow, being sent back to Vietnam? I mean, I'm sure when you were there in 67, you were hoping it would be over soon, and then you're going back 4 years later. The thing is still going on, and you've got to leave behind your wife and kids again. What do you remember about that second tour?
Well, I remember when I went the second time, I made my mind I wasn't going to go the third time, that I'd get out before I would go again. The Army was starting to send sniper training teams into the larger units, Army units in Vietnam, usually division level, and they had gone in, I think, first one went in about 2 years before that, probably around 1969. So we were getting ready to send sniper training teams to the Marichal and the 101st Airborne. My good friend Jack Foster, who had been on the Mexico Olympic team with me, was picked to take be the OIC officer in charge of the 101st team, and I was picked to take the team to the Marichal division and replace the team that was over there in country. We'd go in and replace them. So I went through sniper school, sniper training, and I had a crew of about 8 or 10 instructors, sergeants, and all of them had shooting backgrounds. And so I was kind of looking forward to going on this tour because I felt like I'd be doing something, you know, I knew a little bit about, and I thought it would be a little better tour. No, I really didn't want to go, but it didn't bother me near as much to go the second time because I knew that it would probably go pretty quick, the whole tour, and I should enjoy it, and I would be enjoying what I was doing. So we went in country in January of 71. Coming to Saigon, well, there was a sergeant there that had used to be in a marksmanship unit, and he knew we were coming, he met us at the plane, and somehow they got our whole team transferred to go to a Vietnamese unit and build a sniper school and train them and arrange for them. So we spent the first 2 months just north of Saigon at a Vietnamese training camp and built a range, trained instructors, and did the whole thing. And then after that, then we went to Chu Lai, which was up on the coast, replaced the team that was there. Actually, they'd already gone the time we got there. So we started out, and then we started training snipers for the AmeriCal, maybe 20 a month. We'd have like a three-week training period. We'd train that many, and then they'd go to the field. And in the meantime, the ones that were out in the field, they would come in, they got a chance. They'd come back to our area, and the gunsmith would go over their guns, and they'd stay a couple of days with us, and all the sergeants, the cadre, all their stories, and then they'd be back to the field. So we had like 151 snipers in the field at the time, so we had quite a few out there. But in 1971, there wasn't a lot of contact with the enemy. Things had died down quite a bit. There was no contact unless they wanted to have contact, so there wasn't a whole lot of sniping going on in that particular year. I had one sniper killed in action while I was there, but they employed him completely wrong, and they left him in too long, and should never have happened. But I enjoyed the tour. It was a lot of fun. I don't know if you ever saw the TV show McHale's Navy. Well, pretty much like that. And in order to get by, you had to trade something. We had an electric welder that the other team had managed to trade the CBs when they were there. The CBs were leaving, so they supposedly gave them 24 cases of beer, and they got that welder and a flush toilet. And so they were sitting there when we got there. Well, the welder wouldn't work because we needed spark plugs. So I rode home and had my dad send me spark plugs for it. We got it fired up. So we only had one of the two welders on the whole division base. And so people were calling us all the time wanting something fixed. Usually it was mess halls who wanted to fix their sinks. So I had one guy on my team who was a welder. So they'd hook up the Jeep and they'd pull the welder down there and fix it. And the cook would give him a case of steaks. But anyway, that was kind of the way the whole year went, and it was a lot of fun, and I thought we accomplished a lot, too. And I wouldn't trade that year for anything. I thought that was...
You mentioned training snipers, and I guess the natural question that I should ask for the sake of our listeners is, what are the important things that you were training them to do? What did it take at that time for a sniper to really be good at his duty in Vietnam? What were the things that you were trying to impart to these guys?
Well, we trained them to be employed in pairs. One would have a rifle and one would have a telescope or a spotting scope. That's how they were supposed to be employed. And they were supposed to go out at night or be put in somewhere where they could find a hide and build themselves a hide where they're camouflaged in and just observe. And if they got the opportunity to engage the enemy, they would engage them and then get up and move. They didn't stay there. They'd move somewhere else and then extract them as soon as you could. So we trained them that, but primarily what we trained them in is marksmanship. The Army, at that point, did not train their soldiers very well in marksmanship. They didn't teach them basics. So he was like taking a grass green kid who he had gone through basic training, and he knew how to pull the trigger on a rifle, but if he hit something, he didn't know why, and if he missed it, he didn't know why. So we trained them to hit targets out to 900 yards. We used what we call the M14, the semi-automatic service rifle. We were the first to use that rifle in sniping. Most of the rifles used were Winchester or Remington bolt-action rifles. That's what the Marines used in their sniping. But we used the M14, and we had a 3x9 power Redfield scope mounted on the rifle with a camming device. So when you zeroed the rifle to 300 yards with your crosshairs, you were automatically zeroed all the way up to 900, because when you turned your scope to a higher power, it cammed itself on the receiver and lowered itself, and you're automatically zeroed all the way up to 900. Well, the way you did that is you had two stadium arcs, one above and below the crosshair, and the stadium arcs fit your enemy from the head to the waist. So when you put the scope on a soldier, you cammed the scope until the head and waist fit between the stadium arcs. That meant you were zeroed at that range. And out to about 600 yards, it was almost guaranteed a first round hit, because you were in a foxhole, or you were covered in a supported position, and you're squeezing the trigger, and you're zeroed, and you got a guy on a spotting scope watching, and he sees what happens. He's reading the wind for him to give him windage and so on to get the chance to shoot. And shooting that semi-automatic, he'd go bang, he'd give you a direction, you go bang again, which you couldn't do with a bolt gun. So I was not sold on semi-automatic sight. Thought it had to be a bolt gun to be a sniper rifle. Well, I found out it does it. It was a very effective sniper rifle, and the system we had worked very well. But these kids would come in, I'd talk to them the first thing, and tell them by the time they're leaving, they're going to be hitting man-sized targets out to 500 yards on every shot. And you could just see them, oh, yeah, yeah. We've heard this kind of stuff before, yeah, yeah. Well, by the time they were done, they were. So it was very encouraging for us, and especially me, to see this transformation took place in these kids. Because when they would come in from the field, they'd come in every once in a while, go to back to their battalion area, just for stand down for a day or two. Well, they didn't want to go to their battalion area, they wanted to come to the sniper school area so they could talk to the NCOs, tell war stories. And it's amazing the transformation took place in these kids at that point. So that was very rewarding.
I feel like I need to ask you this, and I know you're not looking to pat yourself on the back and not looking for attention, but it occurs to me, if that was the case, if you took in guys that were very green and might have been a hazard to themselves and others out in the battlefield, and you turned them into guys who could be very effective at this task, that the work you did probably saved a lot of American lives. Is that how you feel? Was that why you were doing it?
No, I was doing it because it was my job, but I enjoyed doing it because it was doing something that I understood and believed in. I'm not sure that it saved a lot of American lives the particular year that I was there, because, like I say, there wasn't a whole lot of contact. Really didn't have that many kills the year I was there. Now, the first year that we sent a team over to the 9th Infantry Division in the Delta, they had a tremendous successful year making kills. I mean, they were talking about kills. I guess you shouldn't be talking about kills, but basically they had a lot of targets. And at that school, a lot of the instructors also sniped. My division, the general, wouldn't let the instructors go to the field. He says, it's not your job to snipe, it's your job to train. And so we didn't get to go to the field. We didn't do any sniping.
But there would be some close calls for Lonus Wigger in Vietnam. We'll get to that when we come back. Plus, 8 years after his first Olympic gold, after surviving two tours in Vietnam, he won gold again in Munich. And he'll tell us about it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.